Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and director of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
Immigration and the backlash to immigration is certainly one of the most important topics of our times. We have seen this play out repeatedly during the Trump presidency, before he was president. It has occupied a central role in political debate. What's remarkable from the perspective of the historian is just how long this story has been going on and how frequently we've seen different variations of this dynamic play out throughout American history as we have debates over questions of citizenship, over questions of border and labor. Although we tend to focus on Central America, Latin America, Mexico in this day and age, we've seen the backlash unfold with many different groups throughout American history. One were the Chinese immigrants, who are a crucial story in 19th century American political history that play a big role in shaping the contours of immigration policy and citizenship right to our time. Today, we will be able to talk about this with a terrific guest, Professor Beth Lou Williams, who is a historian at Princeton University, a U.S. historian focusing on Asian American history. Her book, The Chinese Must Go, Violence, Exclusion, and the Making of the Alien in America, is out with Harvard University Press. And it provides a fascinating look at the events that surrounded the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Beth, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we can jump right into it and you can just help our listeners understand what the Chinese Exclusion Act was and why it occupies an important place in your book.
Well, one thing that we have to understand is in the 19th century, there wasn't a sort of the federal immigration control that we have today. There wasn't an assumption that borders had to be controlled, that certain immigrants would be excluded. And what we see in the 1880s is the restriction and then the exclusion of Chinese is the beginning of border enforcement at the federal level in the United States. The exclusion came after the Chinese started to arrive in the United States in the 1850s. Starting with the gold rush in California. And it was actually not that many people, only about 100,000 Chinese were in the country in the 1880s. But they were concentrated in the West Coast, in California, where because of the fact that most of them were male, they made up to 20% of the workforce. And there was a large movement against them, fear of them as a racial competitors in the workforce. And this brought about the first federal law that excluded a group based on race and class.
And just so we understand, how and why were they arriving to the United States? What was the process of the migration? And what were some of the factors behind why there was a demand for the labor?
Well, one thing that's important to say is that America went to China before the Chinese came to America. So after the revolution, Americans, traders immediately set their sights on China and the Orient with the hope of getting valuable Chinese merchandise like silk and tea. And so they entered the China trade and they participated sort of from the outskirts during the Opium Wars that helped to open China to increasing numbers of amounts of Western trade. And once Americans were in the port cities of Guangdong, the Chinese there in southeastern China had more and more exposure to America, and so they learned of the California gold rush that began in 1849, And like so many people from around Latin America, across the United States and in Europe, they came first for that gold rush in California. But then increasingly they came for jobs. In the western United States, before the Transcontinental Railroad, there wasn't a lot of white workers in California. And California was trying to develop at the time. They needed to drain the swamplands of California, to fell the trees, to build the transcontinental. And this meant that there was a large scarcity of labor in the West for sort of low-skilled wage labor. And that's one of the reasons that large numbers of Chinese men immigrated to the United States.
And you hinted at some of the reaction that unfolded here when they arrived and when they were here. What was some of that at the local level?
At the local level, from the very beginning, there was prejudice against the Chinese as outsiders, especially among the lower class white workers in California. I talk about in the book how really, there's lots of racial tropes about the Chinese, but I think that there's two things that are really central. They were seen as heathen coolies. And there's two parts of this. The heathen part was about the fact that Chinese were believed to be racially inferior, to be savage, to be barbaric, barbarians that were not Christian. And there was a belief that this heathenism was racial, and that is, it was innate, and it could not, it would not change over time, that they would not assimilate to the United States. The other part of this trope is the coolie. So there was an assumption that Chinese came over as a form of slave labor, that they were indentured to their owners, and that they would be sort of a new form of slave labor right after the Civil War had ended African-American racial slavery. And so that fear that there could be a new racial slavery, this time in the West, where the owners were monopolists and the Chinese were essentially slave working labor, was a fear at the local level. And this was expressed in very, small quotidian ways in which how the Chinese were treated on a daily basis. But in my book, I talk more about, broad mass incidents of violence against the Chinese.
What was the role of government, let's say, of politicians in either encouraging this local violence or protecting people from this violence?
So it's mixed. I think that when we look... I often get asked whether the government participated in this violence. And it's a complicated answer because it's hard to tell sometimes where the state, the government stops and starts again. So if we take, for example, the community of Tacoma, Washington Territory, where there was a large expulsion of the Chinese in 1885. It was not purportedly by the government, and it was not through local ordinances, but who participated? Who were the vigilantes in this incident? It was, among many other white men, the sheriff of the town, the mayor, the probate judge, the fire chief. I mean, these are people that were local officials and participated in the violence. I think there's also a way to think about the role of the federal government in this violence that, I talk about. One of the things that's interesting to me is that the violence against the Chinese, really the largest uptick of it was in the mid-1880s after the federal government had purportedly excluded or restricted Chinese immigration in 1882.
And so Chinese restriction.
Yeah, Chinese mm-hmm. Restriction Act of 1882. And I think that it fascinated me why it would be that there would be so much violence in the West during a time when supposedly the federal government had already excluded the Chinese. And I think that the answer lies in part that by, racially marking the Chinese and saying that they were undesirable immigrants, that the federal government had in some ways given license to this level of local violence, that we have to think about you know, I think about it today, that federal immigration policy also affects, you know, the immigrants within the nation and just sort of the image of all of them, no matter how long they have been in the country. You know, if we talk about Mexican Americans today versus Mexican immigration, that it affects how we see. At the time, it affected the way that local communities reacted to the Chinese in their country.
Beth, the violence you're talking about, what did it look like? I mean, what are we actually talking about in terms of the incidents you looked at?
Yes, it's a form of violence that I think is specific to the Chinese. Or different than some of the violence that we see at the same time against other racial groups. The Chinese were primarily the target of expulsion in the mid-1880s. And by expulsion, I mean that they were driven out of communities through all sorts of different forms of both physical violence, but then also intimidation, coercion, harassment. It's important to me to think about what, you know, to think about this violence in comparison to the other forms of racial violence that occurred in the, you know, late 19th century. You know, it's very different than what we see in the South, for example. There was a lot of violence, as we know, during Jim Crow against African Americans. But the violence there, for example, the lynching of black men was often a form of sort of staggeringly lethal violence, where it was, you know, a spectacle. There would be a public lynching, and that sort of violence scholars have argued, a form of disciplining the larger community. You would attack a African-American, often man, who was a pillar in the community, and this would keep the rest of the African-American community in line. That was the theory. With the Chinese, we don't see that same level of, like, sort of spectacle around the violence. Instead, there was a belief that the Chinese workers were now unnecessary, that there were enough white workers in these towns, and that the white working class, these vigilantes, could simply drive the Chinese out of town and often burn down the buildings that they had occupied and that they would not return.
I'm interested in the fact that these things did look kind of different. I mean, in your book, you write about, I guess, if I remember correctly, the people who were engaged on the American side and the Chinese side were Briard and Zhang. And workers were not entirely without rights. It seemed like there was a way to adjudicate offenses that had been committed against Chinese in the United States. And so it wasn't quite the same as public lynchings or being treated as an underclass. It seemed like they also got some consideration.
Yes. So I argued that sort of the diplomatic agreements that the United States had had with China at the time did give the Chinese a kind of protection that other groups like African Americans did not have. That is, a nation was backing them. So it's interesting, one example of the effect of this is that there were a series of criminal court cases that were brought against vigilantes that expelled the Chinese. They expelled the Chinese, I should say, for more than 168 communities in the West during 1885 and 1886, only about a 14-month period. So there were a lot of criminal cases that were brought for these expulsions, assault, murder, conspiracy, but none of those actually led to conviction of any vigilantes in any location that I was able to find. However, there were also redress hearings that the federal government conducted in order to appease the Chinese government. And so representatives of the federal government went to some of the places of expulsion and massacre in Rock Springs, Wyoming, for example, or in Tacoma and Seattle. And they heard testimony from the Chinese that had been expelled. And this sort of redress hiring is important to me in part because it's a venue in which Chinese immigrants talk about their experience of violence, which helps me talk about what this violence meant to them. But also for them, it did result in the United States paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in redress to the Chinese government. Unfortunately, there is no evidence that any of that money actually was then sent to the Chinese immigrants, to the Chinese merchants.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, whether it sounds like it went to the government and not to the people. So I was curious about, speaking of courts, I was curious about ideas that we take for granted now that seem to have had their origin in that time. Ideas about what it means to be a citizen and how to interpret things like birthright citizenship. My impression from reading your book is that a lot of those ideas are tied up in how Chinese were treated in the U.S. at that time.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think about is the meaning of alienage in the United States. And so we often think about this same time period, the mid-19th century, as the birth of modern American citizenship.
Right, it was great. Hooray for America.
Yes. Right? Yes. So with the, with the 14th Amendment 150 years ago in 1868, we have the first national definition of citizenship, and then the federal government pledging essentially to protect these citizens from abuses by the state. This is very different than what happened before that. Before the 14th Amendment, there were both aliens and citizens, but that was not sort of the central way in which we defined membership in American communities.
And people could just show up.
Yes, they could just show up. Yeah. And in some places, they could do things that we think of should be only citizens should be able to do, like vote.
Aliens could vote?
In a couple states, okay, and a couple times, yeah. not in general. And what happens with that 14th Amendment is not only is citizenship extended to more people, namely African Americans, but it also is given all of these new rights, immunities, and privileges. And what I argue in the book is that when citizenship suddenly got this new importance within our society, which I think it still holds today as sort of a central tenet of what membership in America is, it meant that the United States had to then define who were going to stand outside those ranks, who would be the aliens, how long would they be aliens, what rights would aliens possess, would unauthorized aliens possess those same rights? And so what I argue is that the Chinese and this sort of the series of laws that regulated the Chinese, as well as the violence, because the Chinese were seen as sort of the quintessential alien during this time period, as what I said before, they were not only foreign, but they were assumed to be incapable of assimilating and becoming American citizens. Part of this was racial, but part of this was actually legal, that there was a racial bar at the time against Asians becoming naturalized. So any Asian immigrant who came to the United States could never become a citizen.
So were there border controls? I'm just thinking now in terms of either on the West Coast for Chinese or East Coast for Europeans. What was the situation for border controls and how did that change as a result of this?
So there were sort of state-based laws earlier in the 19th century that regulated certain classes of undesirable immigrants. So instead of regulating, giving a cap like we might have today, a quota, or regulating by nation, there was a list of people that were considered undesirable. This would include people that were radical, that were diseased, that were seen as lunatics, and those, the language of the time was likely to become a public charge, that is very, very poor paupers. And so what happened was that individual states would try to keep out these certain individuals. In general, they were not very effective at this, and eventually the Supreme Court ruled that that immigration was a matter of sort of national security and therefore fell to the federal government and should not be regulated by the states.
So I remember there was a time, just to bring it fast forward, there was an exchange between the infamous Stephen Miller of the Trump administration, who's kind of the point person on restrictionism, nativism, and a reporter, I can't remember who it was, it might have been Jim Acosta, but they were talking about immigration, and the reporter was asking how the Trump administration could essentially go against the basic values of American history in terms of openness to immigrants and a constant influx of new peoples. And I remember hearing that, and part of me thought, okay, well, Miller responded that we also restrict people all the time, and that there was a long history of imposing limits. And your book is kind of, I'm sure that's not what you intend to do, but you are reminding us that a foundational moment, not only in the history of immigration, but in the development of the federal government, was in fact around restriction, that this goes really to the core of American politics, right as the government is taking form in this country. I mean, is that right?
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a lot of people that are rallying around the idea that, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. We have always welcomed immigrants. And as sort of an anti-Trump, anti-restrictionist sort of political message. And I understand the politics behind that, but I actually think that it's true that our country has always been restrictive. There has always been sort of racial basis of federal immigration control back to Chinese exclusion, that this has always been sort of a project of maintaining a homogeneous, more white and elite citizenry. And that we have to reckon with this longer history, and that this is also part of our nation, as opposed to sort of whitewashing it and saying that the United States used to be better and used to welcome immigrants. To make arguments like that, we have to forget the history of not just the exclusion of Chinese immigrants, but other Asian groups. Because after the Chinese were excluded, there was also exclusion of Japanese, of South Asians, eventually of Filipinos who were American nationals at the time. And we see all of these sort of racially based exclusions and then quota laws that were against European immigrants. And all of this is essential to understanding the place that we are in today.
And why is it, the history, it's a really fantastic book. And it, in some ways, it's one of the first comprehensive accounts we have of this. It's not a discovery that the legislation passed. And there's been a lot of writing by historians, by journalists, on immigration at the turn of the 20th century. It tends to focus on Eastern Europeans. There's been a lot of work on nativism. Why is it that this period of Chinese immigration, of the restrictions and the reaction, why hasn't it been addressed? What does it tell us a little bit about how historians and Americans who aren't historians, how they understand that period and some of the limits of what they had been looking at?
I think that part of it is that this is a time during the time period that we usually think about as Reconstruction and Jim Crow. And those are both sort of are narratives that are very East Coast and South. And there's always been sort of a bias against integrating the history of the U.S. West in that. I think there's also, you know, our memory of an early Asian American presence is very limited even to this day. When I teach undergraduates, they often come into my classes, no matter if they were educated on the West Coast or the East Coast, they've learned only two things about Asian American history. They know about Japanese internment during World War II, and they know that Chinese workers helped build the Transcontinental Railroad. And that is sort of the two stories that are told about Asian Americans in our nation. I think that part of the reason that we don't remember it's always tricky who is the we, that the sort of the larger mainstream Americans remember this history is that these laws were so effective and this violence was so effective that very few Asian Americans today trace their family roots back to this time, to the 19th century. And so it means that there are very few people who say, this is my ancestors' history. Most Asian Americans today came in, post-1965.
Sure. My parents came over actually in the early 1960s, and I think of Chinese in that time as being this other era. And to be totally honest, I always wondered, why didn't more Chinese come between that era and now? And I just somehow was completely, and this is speaking as someone who didn't take the history class, completely oblivious to the fact that, oh yeah, there were laws that kept our country out. It wasn't just that we just lost interest in the United States. It's that there were controls. And so this is just something that's just completely passed by. I mean, things like in your book, like why do Chinese people get stuck running laundries? What's left after?
Yes, once you're driven out of
Can't sell cigars anymore. So yes. So I wanted to ask about a parallel to current times. So often I think about our time as a second Gilded Age, and I wanted to make a comparison between back to courts and the Supreme Court. We often look to the Supreme Court as a place to protect individual rights, and so as Julian said, we've got these images of us being a nation of immigrants, and like you talked about, like looking back and seeing how that's not true. The Supreme Court played a role in establishing what was okay in terms of excluding people and boundaries. And it's so reminiscent of what's happening now with banning Muslims from entering the United States. It just sounds the same. So can we hear about some of the Supreme Court cases?
Yeah. So one of the first really central case that the Chinese brought was against Chinese exclusion, and it was Chiang Kai-shek v. U.S. in 1889. And what had happened was the United States had barred the Chinese so quickly, extended their laws in 1888, that the Chinese immigrants were still crossing the Pacific. And this law was put into effect immediately. And so Chiang Kai-shek was one of these Chinese immigrants who simply arrived in the United States, and from the time when he left China and arrived in the United States, he had been barred. And he challenged this up to the Supreme Court, saying that this law violated not only U.S. Treaty stipulations, but also due process and equal protection. Unfortunately for him, he lost. And I think unfortunately for us today, that the Supreme Court ruled that Congress and the political branches have what they called plenary power, that is absolute power over matters of immigration. And what this meant, sort of unfolding over the next few decades, was the sort of separation of criminal and civil law, which was under the judiciary, an immigration law that sort of moved into a realm of administrative hearings held by immigration officials. And what it meant that in immigration hearings, immigrants did not have the same rights, sort of constitutional rights that we associate with other sorts of proceedings. They did not have the right to the same rights to due process and the same constitutional guarantees as before. This was extended in later rulings. Feng Yiqing v. U.S. extended this to Chinese not just that arrived at our border, but that had been long-term residents within the United States. So we see the parallels today.
And it was also things like, just to the extent of today we have the Civil Rights Act, and then we have the erosion of that back then. Amendments to the Constitution that are supposed to extend rights, and here's the Supreme Court, this reactionary Supreme Court that sticks around for a few decades after, we've talked about what public opinion is, but a Supreme Court that's reactionary, that's pulling rights back, and that's being very conservative and reactionary and withholding those from a specific demographic.
Yes.
It just feels really familiar.
Yes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so this is something that's sort of at the edge of your book. It's like it's literally at the edge of the book. It's in your acknowledgement section.
Uh-huh.
And it's, again, this is a business about Muslims and Chinese, and it's about your grandfather, your yaya. And you say that when he was 9 years old, he was held for 39 days.
34 days.
Yes. And I think I want to know a little bit more about that, because that sounds a lot like child separation policies that are happening right now.
Yeah, it was.
Are you okay with?
Yeah, I'm okay. So my great-grandfather came over during the period of Chinese exclusion. And so contrary to law, he was a worker. He should not have been able to enter the United States, but he did somehow. Family lore says that he crossed at the Canadian border. That meant, but then he claimed that he had gotten, that he claimed to be a U.S. citizen, again, against the law. And he did so after the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco had sort of burned to the ground all of the records that could prove or disprove whether a Chinese person had been born in San Francisco. So he claimed to have been born in San Francisco.
A lot of people got in that way by claiming citizenship and so on, right? That seemed like a pretty common way to sneak
in. Yes, yes. That is sort of the equivalent of the undocumented today were sort of the fraudulently documented Chinese at that time. So once he had claimed citizenship, he went back to China and had a wife, and my grandfather was born. And so my grandfather came over as a child. He was sort of summoned by his father, who was back in the United States. And my grandfather was only 9 years old. He traveled with his brother, who was a teenager. But when he came to Angel Island, the immigrant officials were not sure that this was a legitimate case. And so what they did was they separated him from his brother, who was allowed to enter, did not allow him to have any contact with his father, and kept him on Angel Island in detention, and then he was interrogated repeatedly over this time period. And you can see, I have the transcripts now of those interrogations, and you can see why he was kept. He, you know, his answers are not complete. They're not exactly the same as that of his father and his brother. And I think that, but you have to remember that this is a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
Not only is he aware that there's some fraud involved in his entry, but also he just has the memory and capacity of a 9-year-old. He remembered this. You know, it was 34 days, according to the immigration logs. But, I met with my grandfather only a week before he died in 2002. And he told me about those days. And when he told the story, he used to always say that he had been in detention for almost a year, 9 months to a year. And it was not until after he passed that I realized that it was only a little over a month. And I think that sort of outsized description of how long he had been there.
I'm sure in his head it was a year to be apart from family for 34 days.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God.
I know.
34
I know.
Days.
It gives us a sense of the importance of something that, you know, for a 9-year-old, what that meant. And so I thought about it a lot this summer with the family separations that we saw at the border, because, you know, some of those were months and months, but some of them were only a few weeks before people were returned. But, you know, he was still talking about it in his 80s.
Right.
And you have to think about the long-term effect on these children.
There's still hundreds who are still, right, as of today, several hundred.
Yeah.
Beth, was that a big part of how you decided to tackle this subject and write the book, meaning from your own family lore and these stories?
Well, in some ways, I think that what I realized growing up was that the stories that I was told by my family were not being taught to me in school. And so it was that sort of search for understanding, you know, how it is that Chinese immigrants were held on Angel Island for this long, what were the laws that created that, that sort of started me on it. I mean, the book eventually became, you know, it starts 50 years, well, more than 50 years before my grandfather arrived in the country. I think what I say in the acknowledgments is that I'm sad that when he died, I did not yet understand this history, because he held this as a very personal shame that he had come over in an unauthorized way, and that he had been held like this. This was still a source of shame and fear for him in his 80s. And I think so that now I feel like I could tell him more about what created the laws and policies that that made him feel this sense of shame and fear.
Well, it's a wonderful way to end our interview. We're out of time, but it's always great to hear how historians, some of what goes into the book or what who they hope to tell their story to beyond their readers, and it's often someone in their family. So once again, our guest with Professor Beth Lou Williams, whose book, The Chinese Must Go, Violence, Exclusion, and the Making of the Alien in America, Harvard University Press. It's out, it's available everywhere, and it's really, really a fascinating book. So people should pick up a copy and give it a read. So thanks again for joining our show.
Thanks so much.
Once again, thanks everyone, and you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us on the show, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.